Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Kostura.
Hello everyone, happy new year.
And this is the weekly segment that features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and some hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of January 7th, 2025. All right, Tom, what do you got for us to kick us off?
All right, so kicking it off today, an article that came from Socket. It's titled Quasar Rat Disguised as an NPM Package for Detecting Vulnerabilities in Ethereum Smart Contracts. So a malicious NPM package called Ethereum Vuln Contract Handler was discovered by the Socket's threat research team. This package was pretending to be a tool for detecting vulnerabilities in Ethereum smart contracts. However, its true goal is to deploy the Quasar Rat to developer machines. So on installation, it retrieves a malicious script from a remote server, executes it silently to deploy the rat on Windows systems. And the package is still live on NPM at the time of this article's publishing, but it has been petitioned to have it removed. Once the malicious script is pulled down and executed, a hidden PowerShell script or PowerShell scripts and commands are set to trigger the Quasar Rat infection. And that rat then becomes embedded within the compromised environment, ensures persistence by modifying the registry. As an example, the Microsoft Windows current version run key. And then it also renames itself to client.exe to try to become non-suspicious. And then once that foothold is kind of gained, it'll begin establishing C2 connections to allow for continued persistence, updated commands, things of that nature. So the NPM package basically, or NPM is basically, you know, the world's largest software registry. This kind of adds to the realm of things that we've talked about in past shows, scenarios with compromised GitHub repos and things like compromised PyPI packages. So I kind of, you know, this is a short kind of touch point one, but you know, this brings to the heat that it seems like this is continuing to be a thing and it's hitting different areas. When I seen it relative to NPM, I was like, okay, we need to talk about this. Also, interesting point too, the Quasar Rat's been around for like a decade. So it was, there's something maybe dig into there with the use of it. But a couple questions off the top I wanted to toss to you, Scott. So, you know, really understanding that it seems to be continuing to grow as a target area to consider these software repos or these package repos. What kind of approaches do you think are realistic to kind of aid in protecting environments? And then from there, like, what about hunting for these kinds of things? Like we've touched on these and really the behavior of what happens after they've gone. But I'm just curious if we could bring it back a layer and just talk about like, you know, how can we protect, you know, how could you protect against this in a realistic way? There's a lot of offered ways that I've seen, or you think about a lot of the different kind of like blanket controls you could put over certain environments. But I think you and I know that that's a lot harder lift typically than it's usually talked about. It seems like, oh, that's just something you should do. But it's not always easy in organizations, especially for developers that kind of need a bit of fluidity to develop and access some of these packages. So yeah, you know, what do you think are good ways to protect? And then what do you think might be some creative ways we could maybe even brainstorm about how you would hunt for stuff like this?
Yeah, so this is interesting because I think this is a problem that isn't just solved by a single team, you know, or a single team holding responsibility. I feel like it's all about process and different teams' responsibilities and basically strengths and skill sets. So I think this is a really popular problem because it's a place that isn't scrutinized, you know, because parts of a solution versus a full solution. Like, it's really easy to say, hey, we can spot something virus total and have a bunch of AV scanners run against it or whatever is a full solution. But when you have parts of a solution being pulled into potentially even your own products, it's much harder to do that. And there's some solutions out there that will actually, you know, crawl the code and make sure the code is secure. Sometimes it might even look for things that stand out as, you know, potential problems. I know developers use these types of tools. I don't know them all top of my head, but how I look at like processes around some of these things is, one, it just like anything else when it comes to security best practices, is knowing what packages are being utilized, right? And that's either like making sure your developers have a way to track that. So if they're going to be using packages, they have like a centralized, these are the packages we're using. We have a tool that enumerates that for us. Even if you have access to some of the code, because a lot of these packages, you know, in a lot of coding base, usually you're importing them. So even if you just see like the header of a lot of code that's being used in your environment, you'll see all the imports and what packages they tie to, so that you can kind of build that list that way as well. And then, your intel team, if you have a good intel team that, you know, understands tech enough, I think it's really good to build profiles for, have them dig into what are malicious packages out there, and then traits around that, like who are the publishers, what is the frequency of the publishing, was it a known publisher that then got popped and then now they have malicious code in there, was it just a brand new package, was it a typo type package, and looking at those type of traits, I think you can start building out ways to flag when you start seeing packages that you're inventorying and maybe enriching some of those nuances to say, hey, this is kind of meets the criteria of things we've seen that may have been bad in the past or something to that regard. And now you have processes to maybe how you would analyze them or look at them. You know, some technical experts that can quickly look for specific things. You know, one of the things that always stands out too, if you are looking at the data, so there's not an automated approach yet for these types of things, but as people build processes and good processes around this, I think you can start automating certain aspects. But obfuscation is a really big thing, right? When you see loads of obfuscation in code base, it's harder to trust because you don't know what's being done. But also, most adversaries don't use non-obfuscated code anymore. It still happens, and it happens even by the greater adversaries or more capable. It just depends on their purpose. But it's a great thing to look for, and it usually stands out pretty easily because when you look at it, it looks more jumbled and harder to understand than just normal code. So there's that. So those are some things, but also, you know, from a threat hunt perspective, if you're not the one analyzing packages, looking at the kind of behaviors that follow malicious packages are also beneficial, right? So like in this instance, you can see where there's a, it was running a bunch of PowerShell hidden window type commands, right? As well as doing a curl to grab a file of a certain extension, which is also good to know. Like a .cmd is kind of like a batch file. Right. So, you know, that's something that is worth noting. And especially it's dropping it at the temp. Like, is that also, you know, an interesting location? So some of the normal threat hunting techniques may kind of uncover some of these things without actually trying to manage the package and repos to begin with. But I think it's good to have like a solution from, you know, start to finish. Right. How do you try to reduce the risk? And then how do you address the risk if you know, you now are hit with something and identifying that? So there's a couple different aspects that I think are beneficial. The other thing too, even when looking at like C2 based stuff, you know, C2 usually is harder to pick up on because one, it's going over encrypted channels and it's typically using like HTTPS in a lot of regards, or it has like a tunnel, like hidden tunnel aspect where it's going over DNS or something else, blending in, basically passing the data through another protocol. But in this case, the other thing that's interesting about this rat, it when it was calling out to its C2, is hitting port 7000. So even just from a data like analysis perspective, sometimes it's good to say, hey, here are the common ports that we actually let out of our environment. Because if you had good firewall filtering, most firewalls probably wouldn't let 7000 out unless there was a need or a purpose. So you might see all the drops for one, but even if it does, you can sit there and group, okay, majority of my environment uses these ports. Why do I have a few hosts using these ports? And a good place to start an investigation or a data study or something like that too. So there's a lot of different actions as far as the different responsibilities that different teams have. And if they're working together, I think this problem maybe isn't solved, but it's definitely addressed and mitigated. So that's kind of how I look at it.
Those are all great points. Yeah. Yeah. And then the one part, you know, I won't spend much time on that, but really kind of looking at this, I think one of the other things that stuck out to me, beyond the fact that an NPM package was basically, poisoned or set to cause problems, was the fact that they were leveraging Quasar Rat. It just goes back to that thing that I think we talk about quite a bit is, you know, if it works, you don't gotta change your attack. It's like this thing's been out since 2014, you know, it's been out there quite a while. And seeing it leverage in ways like this and newer ways and stuff like that is interesting. But yeah, so what do you got next for us, Scott?
So I thought it was interesting that you pulled up this specific article or topic because there's a blog post that's, make sure I'm actually looking at the right one. Yeah, it was posted on the PyPI.org. So they're kind of like the Python package index for... same type of thing, right? Your packages, your relevant libraries, you pull in, you download and stuff like that. And they basically released a thing they call Project Quarantine. And so it's interesting because they're kind of trying to address the similar issue. with identifying questionable packages or releases that they can then put in this quarantine. And when they're in the quarantine, basically the administrators of PI and the authors and then security researchers, I think those are the three groups that can still see that package, but the public cannot until whatever issue has been addressed. And they usually reach out to the package developer for whatever it is that flagged it or why it got reported and so forth. And so it's interesting. So like usually we'll see these things when you do pip installs, right? So that's what I'm talking about when I say PI packages. When you use Python, you want to install a package, you know, pip's a great way to pull down those said packages and kind of manage your environment a little bit. But they, you know, they were talking about like the type of flags they may use. For instance, they get sent a lot of malware reports or reports on packages to them to review from malware researchers and things. So they'll have basically, they usually use that, oh, if there's two or more observer reports on a specific, you know, release or package, they'll move it to quarantine now. Or if there's like the one observer and one non-observer, and I don't really know what the difference between the observer and non-observer is. Maybe one's a report and one is just a person that's not sending a report, but just, you know, complaining or notifying. But that was a reason for them to do, well, that quarantine or a level of quarantine. But they mentioned another live instance where they had somebody they moved to quarantine for kind of what we were talking about in the NPM package before. Right. Which was the obfuscation in the code. So there was a package. It wasn't malicious, but it met the criteria. There was a lot of obfuscation. They said, hey, you know, there's all this obfuscated stuff. You know, we quarantine it based on that. Can you fix it? And the author went back and deobfuscated the code and everything. So then they released it. And I thought it was a great way where kind of like the community, I guess, how you want to or what you want to call it. Is thinking of solutions like this, right? And then if you have some automation that actually can crawl the code and automatically quarantine things and flag the justifications why, like obfuscated code, or, you know, they mentioned different situations based on like number of files versus number release, first time release, all this kind of stuff that can put things in the quarantine, which would be kind of cool. And if this works really well for them, then all these other package managers, if they can kind of follow suit or do what works as well in a similar fashion, this ongoing problem that we've seen, you know, month in and month out, maybe we'll start to kind of get addressed and force attackers to do different things. Because I think what's happening is there's very low resistance from attackers that are able to gain this type of access, utilize these techniques to get in environments and get their stuff installed. Yeah, I know. I thought it was a really cool solution. So it's not so much of a, hey, look at this really cool technical analysis, but I wanted people, it was interesting. We had the technical piece from your side and we actually have a solution proposal that they actually are putting in the works from the Python package index. And it's good for people to be aware of that too. So if you are using Python packages, you can feel, I wouldn't say more confident, but just know that exists. So there are chances where things could be picked up that would protect you otherwise. So I don't know what you thought when you saw this after you found your article.
Yeah, it was interesting that it flowed so well. I was happy about that. But no, this is cool. I like that it's being thought about. I think the approaches here are actually promising with the way that they're looking at really kind of improving the automation standpoint. So, you know, taking the different data points that they're referencing, they mentioned in here that they would look for some automation that might be relative to different combinations of reports for a project being potentially bad, where they, like, if it's two observers and observers that they referenced here were relative to like the actual people that are marked as security researchers, or one observer, one non-observer, non-observers being just general users, and like different combinations of that relative to the other data points that they could, like, you know, make sure that doesn't get necessarily abused, because that could be a problem too. You put a tool like this, you know, you think of video games, you put a cheat thing and everybody's going to complain that somebody's cheating anytime they lose, kind of thing, right? So at least you they're already thinking about that on the onset, which I thought was great. You know, this shows that, like, hey, we have a focused goal with some depth to try to solve a problem that's seemingly snowballing. But yeah, this is really cool. I'm kind of rooting for the success of this. I really hope this takes flight. I think this was great, man.
Yeah, and what I think is interesting too, when I didn't like do this on purpose, but when you asked me, like, how do people possibly address on the last problem with the Quasar Rat, and I kind of said it's not just like a single team's responsibility. When you look at their solution here, they do the same kind of thing, right? They have the administrators that manage the what packages exist. They have the people who are the authors of the package. They have the researchers that are the ones that are like have the added knowledge of basically able to state, verify, or prove out if something is good or bad. Similar aspect, right? But more in the public domain without all the different heads within the same organization or same security team or whatever. So I think that speaks a lot to this isn't a problem that you can just toss to one team's lap and say, solve it, right? I think it really does come back to some collaboration and kind of the point of it all. So that's cool.
And I think another thing that another just a thought idea here, this is just from my perspective, my opinion, but when you see something like this is really cool that they're thinking about it on that side. So you're thinking about it from the PyPI side, right? But when you see things like this, I think what we were talking about in the previous article that I had brought up, where you're looking internal your organization and you're trying to come up with creative ways to manage your solution, you could reference things like this as a way to maybe come up with a creative solution that works for you internally to your org too. So this is definitely a point worth mentioning.
Right, right. Cool. What do you got for us now?
All right. Second one for today from my side. So this one does go back into the realm of discussion more, but I do find it interesting. So I have some, a lot of, I always chuckle a little bit when things like this come up when they're relative to this type of attack, because there's some history there. But I'm referencing an article from the Hacker News. It's titled "When Good Extensions Go Bad." So takeaways from the campaign that was targeting browser extensions. So this article talks about a recent massive targeted attack against Chrome web extensions, where the attack targeted publishers of browser extensions on the Chrome Web Store via a large phishing campaign. And it led to 35, so far identified 35 compromised extensions, and more than 2.6 million users were exposed to data exposure or credential theft. So commonalities in this attack show that the primary extensions that were targets were focused around AI and VPN extensions with a sprinkle of productivity focused extensions, which historically, when we've talked about browser extensions, they usually led to that productivity side, right? Like your PDF editors, things like that.
Yeah.
So this attack targets an area that is commonly disregarded. When you talk about browser extensions, toolbars, things like that, and I think with the evolution of workflows like AI enhancements and other things, tools like browser extensions are going to become more exponentially more utilized, not just for ease of use, but maybe for like real workflows and like necessary workflows. And the article does reference various ways to consider protecting an org from these kinds of points of entry. We're talking things like auditing all extensions, categorizing them, enumerating the permissions that extensions are granted or might need, assessing the extension risk, apply adaptive risk-based enforcement. And that would be awesome to accomplish in theory, but I think, at least from my experience, most orgs, that's not a small undertaking. That's not a simple thing to do. And to manage it properly without potentially limiting that user base, or you might limit them in other ways by the natural process of trying to control that sector. So I kind of expect that this attack is likely not large enough for companies to really to like make, you know, when something along the lines of, hey, we need to pay attention to a certain sector or area of attack, usually a big attack has to happen for everyone to kind of wake up and say, hey, let's focus on this. This one has kind of been rumbled about in closets over the years.
Yeah.
And usually people come out laughing like, that's not really a place to consider. And I don't think this article is necessarily going to move that needle, but I did think it was interesting to talk about because it is notable. You know, really just want to extend the shining of light on this area. Maybe even shout out to some of the potential SecOps folks that are listening to us. To consider this as an area as a potential entry point. I know from past experiences that visibility in the extensions isn't always easy unless you're really set up to look at them. But when you're investigating or hunting for activity that runs you like into a dead end as far as like how something might have happened, that path might just lead you back to a browser extension. So it's something that I just, you know, mostly wanted to bring to the conversation piece, bring it to the forefront when I see it. You know, this isn't a sky is falling area, but definitely something we should consider. And, I'll take a breath, Scott. What do you think about this?
So yeah, I think it's interesting because probably over the past 2, maybe 3 months, we've been seeing reports where Chrome extensions have been leveraged, where there's a malicious extension that's not really masking as much per se, but the part of the malware persistence piece or install is about getting in, basically pulling down a malicious extension and then forcing it to be installed and run. And this is interesting because now they're talking about, well, if we go after the publishers and developers and insert our code, just like attacking packages and package management, you know, it's a similar approach. Now, there's a couple of things that I'm kind of curious about. I don't obviously develop for these said companies or whatever, but I feel like if for you to be allowed to publish things publicly, especially when you're talking about like a Chrome store and things like that, I would expect you by default, they force two-factor authentication and maybe some other types of verifying controls, right? To basically prevent people from stealing things and jumping in and publishing things that easily. Not saying that that won't be defeated, but I would hope that's at least being done on their end for being a responsible party for housing all this stuff. The other thing is when we talked previously about these types of extension attacks, if you want to call them that, there are really, I would say, three things, but it's really two things to look for from someone taking advantage and pulling in their own extension. And that is when you look at the registry keys, there is a policy under, if you were either on the local machine Hive or the current user Hive under software policies, Google Chrome, you know, with backslashes all the way out there, there's the extension install force list. This is a place where someone could put what their extension is that they wanted to pull down and run and then make sure it's running for persistence for malicious extensions, as well as sometimes the shortcut file for Chrome itself can be an argument can be added to the target path, the --load --extension, and then the path to the extension. Another way to persistently load when someone launches Chrome, especially via the shortcut. So obviously, if you have monitoring set up for those registry keys for that type of attack, or you set up monitoring for just, you know, file creates for shortcut files by LNKs, you should see where something happened to a Chrome shortcut and that might be suspicious. You won't see the data unless you actively go investigate, but you'll be aware that something may have happened. So those are some things to look at for that type of attack. Now, what's interesting is there is not a quick and easy, sad way to see what extensions exist in your environment. In the case here, right, you're kind of talking about where extensions are being basically made malicious from the developer code itself. So the extensions start out as a very popular, well-known, useful tool, and now injected bad code comes into play. And how do you really defend against that? So sometimes it's good to know what extensions are running in your environment. And I typically try to solve these things either via registry or file create data. And in this case, there really isn't a good registry location that monitors what are the currently installed extensions. Like, there's different ways you could try to use PowerShell or Chrome itself to pull that data, but that's a lot harder to do remotely on your entire environment. But for file creates, if you're actually looking at the local app data path, Google Chrome user data default and extensions folder, then you can actually create like sysmon rule, for instance, anything in that directory, give me a log for it. That means every time an extension is being basically installed, that's where it's going to live. And you'll see record of that. And what's nice is maybe, you know, you can identify what are normal extensions being utilized within your environment as a whole, as well as what are some rare extensions that, you know, very few people are using and do they need those or where do they get those, and that kind of assessment and understanding, because like security already always starts with what do you know about, you know, you essentially, and that's similar to the package management solution that I mentioned earlier, right? Like, hey, what packages are you running in your environment as far as your dev environment, as far as the things you do in production? Same kind of approach, right? Understand what extensions are out there. There's easy ways to collect this data, I think, if you just create some simple sysmon rules, or if you have an EDR that actually will, you know, track those types of files. I don't know what the file extensions are for extensions. I didn't get that far into digging in. I just know the location where they usually show up. So yeah, so it's just kind of like being aware, right? And, you know, that's kind of always the first step to solving difficult problems like this, where the problem became a problem, not because your environment's insecure, but because someone else was that affected you. It's like kind of like the supply chain, right?
It's exactly that. It's really kind of an echo of the supply chain stuff, and it's smaller, right? Because you're going after people that are building different apps or browser extensions, or, you know, it's add-ons or things like that. So, you know, in this case, they just went to the Google Chrome store and found the developers and dropped a large phishing campaign and hit a few. The other interesting thing is no one's immune to this. Based on the report from this attack that happened just a week and a half ago, Cyberhaven was actually the first group that noticed it and got hit by it, and they really quickly reported it and worked to remediate it, which was great. But you know, everyone, you know, you're going in, you have a trusted extension, you're doing your normal day to day, you know, you hit a phishing email and bow, you know, something comes from that. You know, just to add on, because, you know, Microsoft is quite large, and I don't know how many people, it's not a one-stop solution at all, but there is also ways to leverage some of your, you kind of touched on EDR, some of your potential, your hooks into your environment, like Microsoft, for example, has like an app security platform. So it used to be called MCAS. They changed it every week. I honestly don't know what it's called now. But that gave you some insight into extensions that were added or permissions that were granted to extensions, which is, you know, could be more important in certain cases. I know historically I've seen different apps, random extensions or apps that were allowed to have permissions in an environment that were a little scary, right? Like, because, you know, most users, I'm trying to get a tool, I'm trying to do this thing, I'm trying to edit this PDF. Okay, yes, accept all. I'm not reading through the fine print. I have no idea what I'm giving access to. And suddenly it has access to your 2FA and all these other things. And it's like, yeah, you just opened up a can of worms that somebody could potentially utilize. But there's things out there. And it's something that I think that, it's not skies falling, but right. This shouldn't be an area that goes overlooked, because it's clearly being leveraged and it's clearly being thought about from an attacker standpoint of how they could effectively leverage this. And this is case in point.
You know, you made me think of a parallel. It's almost like what's being attacked is what people aren't managing. So another parallel to this is, look at remote admin or remote management tools, right? If you don't do software management and a standard attacker just puts in a remote management tool to have remote access into your environment, if you have good software management, you'll know about that. And not only that, but if you see it, you'll know it's wrong. But for people that don't do software management, as far as like approved software and things like that, they're usually susceptible to those things. And when it comes to Chrome, same thing in Windows. I think you might be able to pull down the basic template from Chrome itself or Google, but there's .admx files, which are like basically policy files that you can basically build custom policy for different apps you run in Windows environments. And there's one for Chrome itself where, like, what extensions would you run? Do you allow extensions? Do you do whatever? Like, you know, how you want to micromanage that as much as possible. Those exist too. So if you chose to use, say, Chrome in your environment and you wanted to actually manage the app, yeah, there's a level of overhead, but you can make those rules pretty loose and still have good control of your environment, at least a known level of control, so you know what's out of bounds and what's inbounds. Those things exist too. So attackers will definitely take advantage of things that are unmanaged. I mean, that's just in general. You have unmanaged boxes not getting updates. You have unmanaged software that they can take advantage of. You have unmanaged accounts that they steal and use for other things. Usually things you neglect are what they take advantage of, you know, most often than not. So it's just a good example of that.
Yeah, that's a great point. All right, Scott, what do you have last for us today?
So last, you know, once again, kind of another talking piece, and it's what's coming up, right? So we have Windows 10, which will be coming up end of life. And I think this is always a good conversation, because I think especially some of the larger organizations probably get hit with this. And then maybe some of the smaller ones that don't necessarily have the right hardware to support moving to something like Windows 11. Because one of the big requirements of updating to Windows 11 is you need the TPM chip. That's like without exception. You have to have the right hardware up to a certain point to be able to even use Windows 11. And for security concerns, right? They manage how they store keys and other types of sensitive and secure data by leveraging the TPM chip itself. But the Windows 10 will be going into life in October 14th. And it's just like everything else, where theoretically you could still pay to have support. And it was like per device for the first year, it's $61 per device. Second year, $122 for the per device for second year. Then it goes to $244 for the third year. But I think they're only adding three extra years, right, of support for that. And so something that a lot of people should be considering. I think this is what really helps helps determine the true maturity of the security in an environment. Is, are they aware of this? Do they have a plan in place? And have they justified things or spent the time to justify things properly, right? Because, you know, you should be able to understand how much is it going to cost if we extend this versus if we replace things. What is the things, have we identified everything that needs to be replaced? And not only that, what's your plan, you know, if your plan is to replace everything, what's your plan to look for things after the fact, right? So you can make sure there's nothing rogue system that just gets turned on. And so you will be able to identify that, because you probably want a process where you're looking for those things maybe a year or two out from when you thought you rolled everything off, in case there is that one machine that just kind of comes online. Because usually what ends up happening is a machine will come online. If you don't have the extended service, it's not going to get any net new patches. And if that, you know, break all vulnerability comes out that they're not going to fix, that's easily exploitable, you open yourself up kind of easily to risk, depending on where that machine comes online in your environment. Now, the one thing I don't like is the way this article, so the article is called Windows 10 Users Urged to Upgrade to Avoid Security Fiasco. It's a Bleeping Computer article. You know, I don't think it's sky is falling as they want to make it sound, but I think they do that because, I mean, if you remember back in the Windows 7 days, it took forever for people to roll off Windows 7, and I'm pretty sure you still see Windows 7 out in the wild. And actually, they have a Globe stats where this 2.4% of machines they see still running Windows 7. And even a point has almost a fifth of a percent running Windows XP. But, you know, these are just interesting things to be aware of. You know, their global stat count for Windows 10 is still 62%. So that means more than half of the computers seen from this perspective are running Windows 10. That means there's a huge shift that's going to need to happen. And if there's that big of a shift, hopefully, you know, we've had chip shortages before. Maybe you don't want to be caught where you're doing that shift too late, and now you can't get the hardware you need to be able to, you know, possibly upgrade. So there's all these things to consider that aren't as simple as, well, we need to move or we need to not move, right? I think you should really be having these conversations early if you're not already having them. I think you need to think about cost as a big part of that conversation. And also understand, you know, the cost of if we don't do something and something bad happens because of Windows 10, where you're forced to then spend an extra cost to get everything to 11 to kind of restore yourself. That's something to consider too as part of that discussion, because now you're saying, hey, we thought we were going to save here and we ended up spending more, so it might have been better to spend everything up front. Just be aware of those things. And so because this article came up, and I always forget when the end of support date usually lies with a lot of this stuff, I wanted to kind of bring it to light. And it's a good thing to talk about at the beginning of the year, because people are kind of putting together their projects and plans for the year. This should be on there. They should definitely have a plan, hopefully have it in place as far as what you're going to do by maybe June, so you have time to execute. But yeah, it's just kind of like a, I guess, a notification of, you know, you should be thinking about this.
Yeah, it's nail on the head with some of the points I was going to run with the whole, because we didn't pay attention to this right away. Oh yeah, yeah, and we've run into this where, you know, the sky is not falling. The article makes you seem like it is, but it is absolutely worth considering. So like you mentioned the chip shortage, and that was one of the points that I had kind of noted. It's like we do live in a bit of a fragile environment in the world now. And we've seen how quickly a shortage could occur. And there's many different prongs that could zap that into play again. So, you know, a lot of the problem for people that can't upgrade to Windows 11 is hardware-based, chip-based. So, you know, you want to look and really plan to get ahead of that. You know, part of me wonders, too, when I was reading this, Scott, and this is more, you know, to the speculation side, I wonder how many people might be encouraged to move towards a Linux operating system and with something like this. Like that was a thought I had when I read that. Like,
I mean,
to see if they were just that. Right. Yeah. They kind of reference like moving from Windows to Linux.
I thought that was a great mention, right? Was if you can't afford the hardware to basically replace the hardware to then run Windows 11, what going to Linux, even if temporarily, or, you know, for a portion of some of your stuff, might be a good solution. One, if you don't want to pay the licensing, right, for the enterprise support, you can kind of get away with that if you're a small enough company and just try to like figure out how to buy yourself more time, but not be at further risk. But obviously there's license like, you know, Rail, Red Hat, Linux and stuff like that, where you can kind of get the enterprise support and things like that. And there is a cost, there's a license and stuff to it. But it is still a, you can still use the same hardware very easily. Right. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Almost always, almost certainly with any, with almost all the distros. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, the percentage wise was interesting to me. So before I step on that, nerding out really quick, I was unaware of StatsCounter. And I don't know if you checked it out, Scott. I don't know if you went.
I didn't go there.
Site and books. I highly recommend you do, because I know you a little bit, and you're a stats nerd too. There's a lot of really cool things there that I thought were interesting. Really, why I had to go look is because I wanted a little bit of context around the StatsCounter that was in this article. And you had mentioned that there was a point for Windows XP. I thought it's even worth echoing that there's still people hanging out on Windows 8 and 8.1.
Surprised they weren't hit with WannaCry.
Man, like, yeah, it's like, okay, this is out there somewhere for this, you know, this StatsCounter to pull this data in. So it's got to be out there to be potentially leveraged. I'm not trying to encourage that, but it was shocking to see a little bit of that. But yeah, very, very cool site. Very good place to nerd out on some of the data. And they had all kinds of stuff there.
I was going to say those resources are good when you need to have those conversations with other teams and management. Yes. If you're like the sole security guy to say like, look, this is the problem. This is what it looks like to everybody else. We're not the only ones. This is why I recommend whatever. Right. Like, it's just good to have data like that.
100%. And I think that's worth a point to pull out, because you see articles like this, and depending on where your rank and file is in your given org or your setup. I know I've experienced where, you know, certain people that are on higher or running the ship in different areas, they see something like this and there's a little bit of panic that involves or insinuates, and there's things and tools even within this that can help you kind of set a normal conversation, right? And I think this stats kind of thing was really, really cool there. But yeah, you hit most of the points. I mean, you just got to think about it. Don't panic. This is something that you can manage. There's options and ways out of this. But I am really interested to see something like this pushes people more towards Linux. The other part too is, I wonder, when you see the percentages down from previous versionings, and I'm not sure if this necessarily applies to Windows 11, but I'm kind of thinking historically, when you've seen the move to Windows 7, it was pretty well received. And I think even the move to Windows 10, there was, you know, like, there wasn't a lot of barriers to make that transfer. Correct. So with the Windows 11 transfer and the kind of forced to the requiring certain hardware, like, are we creating the resistance? I don't know. Just thinking about it from the side of Microsoft, are you creating the resistance unintentionally, like by trying to do something positive, and now you're having this kind of hesitation or this barrier that's been developed, you know?
Ironically, it's not just the TPM chip that gets in the way. You know, there's obviously older processors that don't support it. And one of the reasons, which I think is good, is Windows for the longest time has had legacy code to support legacy hardware for quite some time. And that's why Windows got so bloated. So I think, you know, there needs to be a time when Microsoft's kind of putting their foot down, which is good they did. There's going to be, you know, some pain points associated with it, but it's good to, let's optimize, you know, where we're at with some things. We don't have all this bloated code everywhere. Kind of like build from the ground up, even though it's weird. Some of the holes you see in 11 as if like, they didn't really build from the ground up. They still moved things over, but either way, yeah, it's
some balance of both, right? Some balancing.
Yeah, it's like one of those things where no one wants to do it, but someone has to. So,
no, that's a great point. That's a great point. But yeah, very, very interesting article. I'm not trying to short sell any of the detail, but yeah, that's kind of thing that's very interesting to me. I can't wait to dive into some of that more just for the fun of it.
Which, you know, it'd be interesting too. Like, if that stats counter, you can pull the same stats and see how it moves throughout the year. That'd be a good incentive to say, hey, like, we're the lingering 5% on, you know, Windows 10. We don't want to be those folks. Some, you know, leadership gets competitive, especially, you know, if they realize they're the only one in their vertical that is falling behind. Because they don't like to say that to the board at any point in time. So yeah. Good thing to be aware of, good thing to think about. And it's really just a good exercise of almost like doing a tabletop with some action items at the end, right? Because a lot of this is really discussion based as far as where do you want to run your business and what risk do you want to take on. Cool. Well, I really think that kind of closes everything out. So I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. So with that, we'll close out the top threat hunting headlines for the week of January 7th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.